from Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.
Welcome to Meet the Press Now. I'm Chuck Todd here in Washington on the second anniversary of the January 6th attack on the Capitol, where so far, a fourth day in a row, House Republicans have not been able to elect a speaker. But for the very first time, Kevin McCarthy appears to have the gavel within his reach. The House just adjourned until 10 p.m. Eastern time this evening. It's giving time for a pair of McCarthy allies to make their way back to D.C. on planes right now for an evening vote. And McCarthy believes he has the votes. Finally, after a night of bargaining, McCarthy gained the support of 15 holdouts today, flipping 14 votes on the 12th ballot and adding Maryland's Andy Harris on the 13th ballot. It's still not enough to become speaker, but he now only needs to flip two of the remaining six holdouts or have some combination of present votes, things like that. And right now he has something he hasn't had all week, momentum. Moments ago, Garrett Haake caught up with Leader McCarthy just off the House floor, and he says he will have the votes tonight.
Yeah, what's it going to take to get over the top here?
We'll get it done tonight.
Okay.
What time?
Just with the two coming back? I mean, you still have some, at least some more members of your conference you have to convince.
I've got a couple members flying back.
McCarthy was the top vote getter in the House on the 12th and 13th ballots for the first time all week. Not by much, but a plurality is something, so he'll take it. And it all comes, though, with a big price. The concessions McCarthy appears to have made to get even this far are going to greatly decrease his power as speaker, if he gets there, and greatly increase the power of the ultra-conservatives in his conference. Any one of McCarthy's critics now is going to be able to call for a vote to remove him at any time. And it means that a Speaker McCarthy will have to be the most conservative speaker in modern political history, while also being the weakest speaker in modern political history. The never-ever Kevin caucus now sits at six. They may be fewer in numbers, but their opposition appears to be just as steadfast as it's been all week, with the rhetoric from Florida's Matt Gaetz turning downright acerbic on the House floor.
You only earn the position of Speaker of the House if you can get the votes. Mr. McCarthy doesn't have the votes today. He will not have the votes tomorrow, and he will not have the votes next week, next month, next year. And so one must wonder, Madam Clerk, is this an exercise in vanity for someone who has done the math, taken the counts, and is putting this institution through something that absolutely is avoidable?
So where do we stand 4 days into the 118th Congress? Well, we don't have a speaker, but Kevin McCarthy is close after giving up pretty much everything the House Freedom Caucus had asked him to give up. Question is, what now and what will legislating look like? Ali Vitale has the latest on the Hill. So, Ali, they're pretty confident. 10 p.m., I've got a source. They think it's a, they don't want to say done deal, but they really think that once they get the two votes that somehow they can convince two of the holdouts to either vote present or something. But confidence seems pretty high, does it not?
Yeah, confidence is high, but we've also entered this phase where anyone who was involved in these negotiations is sort of like crossing their fingers and also trying to stay away from reporters because they're afraid that somehow they're going to jinx this thing in the interim period as they're trying to figure out what combination they ultimately go with, whether it's some people voting present, getting some of the no's to flip, whatever combination. And there's a few different permutations of this that negotiators are working on. And as these lawmakers are out and reporters are looking for them, no one's telling us how they're going to vote, but certainly the people who are in the room feel like they have enough options that McCarthy is going to get there. That's, though, not a sure thing until the clerk says it is. There have been a lot of twists and turns that put us on this four-day adventure, and so I think everyone here is sort of saying, yeah, it's a done deal with a pretty massive asterisk that it's not over till it's over.
Ali, I think that one of the reasons that I've been told of why they want to try to get this done tonight is the more details of the compromise that was made by McCarthy, the more those details leak out, the more unhappy some of the Republicans in the governing wing might be.
Yeah, and look, moderates have been kept apprised of some of the key things on this. But look, when you start talking about cutting spending and balancing budgets based on fiscal year 2022 levels, that sounds pretty arcane. But really what you're saying is the massive budget influx that the Department of Defense got, for example, in this latest omnibus bill, that would go away if you're going on a balanced budget from last year. So there's things that are already starting to trickle out here that have some people, if not, you know, upset enough to change their vote, because I haven't heard that, but upset about what they're about to go into. And certainly that's one of the pieces of this. And then the other piece of this, as you look ahead to what the impact of these negotiations are, how McCarthy got here, it may actually end up being a situation of be careful what you wish for. Okay, you got what you wanted, but now you have to deal within these parameters. The fact that you have the one member trigger on a motion to vacate, that's going to loom large, despite the fact that people who negotiated this tell me, well, they promised they won't abuse or misuse it. Okay, but at the same time, that was one of the things that members had questions about as Republicans were on their full conference call this morning. The other thing here, too, is the more time that elapses, the more that McCarthy loses his momentum. Right. They don't want to take chances here. People say they just got to get it done. That's why we're seeing him come back tonight.
So Matt Gaetz would use the phrase he was only going to support McCarthy if it was a straitjacket, basically, if he became a straitjacket when it comes to the speakership, meaning really restrain a lot of power. It's not that bad, but how are others describing exactly how much power McCarthy gave up?
A lot. I mean, we have seen so much centralization around the speakership from people like Pelosi that the way that McCarthy has given up, even the way that he's picking who sits on the Rules Committee, one of the things that we reported out of these concessions is that they want, House Freedom Caucus wants 3 seats on the Rules Committee. McCarthy can pick one of those seats, and then they're going to give him a list of names, and he can pick the other two based off of that. This is, again, the Freedom Caucus, if not outright making decisions for the Speaker, at least putting parameters on the decisions that the Speaker can make. So he has taken a lot of the power that has been centralized by his predecessors and doling it back out with each new round of these negotiations. So in many ways, Gaetz got what he wanted. There is a sort of straitjacket on McCarthy. And now that's why maybe he starts singing a different tune. I don't know if Gaetz is one of the ones that they can ultimately see flip, right. But you know, he's in the talks.
Ali Vitale. Go see if you can find some less muted members of Congress.
I'll get on the hunt.
much appreciated. Speaking of somebody who is willing to talk to the press right now, I'm joined now by Congressman-elect from New York, Brandon Williams. Well, we might be able to get rid of the elect part. I'm just curious, if there's a speaker tonight, are you going to be sworn in tonight?
Yeah, that's a good question. We've been asking that question. I believe so, because we're all ready to get to work. So, let's change our titles and start passing bills.
Tell me about the meeting this morning. What's your understanding of the compromise that was reached between Chip Roy and Kevin McCarthy?
Well, I'm not a part of those conversations, as you can imagine, as a freshman. Mm-hmm. But what I can say is that the concessions that Kevin has made, I think are good for the conference. I think they're good for the institution of the House. I think they're good for the American people. This is about rules that make the body work, procedures that make it work, and pushing power out to individual members and out to committees. And honestly, I think that's a big improvement. There's been a lot of abuse in the last 4 years and even going back, you know, decades. So I think this is a new day for the House and overall, I'm very positive about it.
Since you're new here, how do you know that's the case?
How do I know?
That it doesn't work before and that this is somehow going to work swimmingly.
Well, $31 trillion in debt is how I know. That's pretty easy to see. And it's also true that bills get passed without debate and on a very short timeline. And that's not how democracy is supposed to work. And that certainly isn't the kind of, check on spending and check on the Biden administration that the American people wanted.
There have been a few sort of reports about the deal that has popped out. A couple of headlines. I want to get you to react to it. One was if they agreed it. 2022 spending levels, it would essentially mean a cut to the defense budget, a significant cut, maybe up to $75 billion. Is that something you're comfortable with?
Well, I've heard that number as well. Mm-hmm. And I think given the threat of China, we're obviously going to have to step up. I'm the first nuclear submarine veteran to serve in Congress in 50 years. I've been a part of strategic deterrence, and I believe that we do need to counter China. So defense obviously is always treated as an exception, and I think that'll be the case here as well.
When you've watched this play out, you're you want a competitive race. You're from a more competitive state.
That's right.
In general, are you at all concerned that you're going to be tied too much to the far right caucus in the Republican conference?
Well, I ran as a conservative and as an outsider in a D+1, race, and I won. And so I think people are hungry for common sense. I think you saw that with Lee Zeldin in New York, who helped us deliver the majority. And I really think that what you're going to see out of the House and with these rule changes is more about common sense and a rein on spending that's been driving inflation. And so, to paint it as left-right, I'm not sure that that's really the best way to think about it.
Well, I understand that, but it does seem as if everything does get decided by left-right in Congress. Do you think you're going to have the freedom to work across the aisle?
Absolutely. There's a lot of things that we can tackle, right? My background is nuclear engineering, and I have a lot of expertise, thousands of hours supervising the operation of a nuclear power plant. I think nuclear power is one of these, as well as other energy policies are one of these issues that even across the aisle that we're going to be able to find some compromise and bring relief and common sense to an energy policy, frankly, standing up to the Biden administration.
Are you comfortable using the debt ceiling as leverage, or do you think that's a tool that shouldn't be used since it sort of plays with the country's credit rating?
Well, I have an MBA in finance from Wharton, so, I understand the credit rating. I think the credit of the United States is very, very good. In fact, I think it's the best in the world. So the credibility of the United States really isn't at risk. I think being able to control our spending is we're at a critical place. We've added, $10 trillion to the debt, just over the last few years, and that's not sustainable. So spending is certainly number one. It's certainly number one from the Freedom Caucus and the issues that they've brought. So I think you're going to see a lot more fights on spending, and in general, I think that's a good thing.
Right, but do you think that it sounds like you're not as comfortable having the debt ceiling being that vehicle? Because if you've got all these changes in the rules, then that's what the budget process is for, the appropriations. Sure. That's where you should have your spending debates, no?
Well, I think with the debt ceiling, you're going to find that, no one's really won by being on the wrong side of that. So, as much rhetoric as there is around it, it's a good, it's a good point that drives a lot of conversations and deal making. But, I feel confident that we're going to put out a budget and a plan that we can get to a balanced budget in 10 years. But that's going to require a lot of look at spending. So,
Congressman-elect Brandon Williams represents a congressional district in and around Syracuse. I appreciate you coming on and sharing your perspective with us. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
All right. I'm joined now by a terrific panel, senior advisor to Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, Faz Shakur, who has also worked for Speaker Pelosi, so knows a little thing or two about speaker power. NBC News congressional reporter Scott Wong, publisher of The Bulwark, Sarah Longwell, and Sarah Chamberlain, president and CEO of the Republican Main Street Partnership. Faz, I threw that extra moniker in there for you because I think of anybody at this table, you're aware of a speaker's office powers. What you have seen that he negotiated away, explain what that means in terms of just simply power of a speaker, not left or right.
Well, the tension over the past couple of decades, at least in the House, has been as there's been more cruel in politics of legislative power has gone to the top. It's gone to both the Senate Majority Leader and the House Speaker in determining which bills are going to be scheduled, how they're going to be crafted, when they're going to be voted on, how they're going to be passed. The committee process has largely died over many, many years. That's not where the forum for main action is anymore on legislation. It's in the Speaker or the Senate Leader's offices. And then you're essentially just your gadfly trying to make it happen out like a Joe Manchin or somebody. So if you're watching what has happened with Build Back Better Manchin, you're trying to position yourself as somebody who wants to agitate with the leadership to change and challenge their power to devolve it back onto you. That's the main thing of what's going on. The problem in this is that sometimes in these fights is like, you have to be willing to say, I'm comfortable with zero. It, essentially a form of nihilism. Mm-hmm. Manchin was that way, right? And Build Back Better. I'm comfortable with zero. Matt Gaetz is saying, I'm comfortable with zero. If there's no speaker, great. So you now put yourself in a position saying, I want more power to some of us as members to govern with you. But my approach to you is to say, I'm comfortable with nothing. Yeah. It's hard to say, how do you govern with that?
Sarah Chamberlain, I know you've been a part of the Republican Main Street Caucus, sort of the governing wing of the House Republicans. Look, the Mr. Smith and me, it would be great to see committees matter again and all of this stuff. Like I, you know, and I've heard progressives have similar complaints as the Freedom Caucus has had in the past about the power of leadership here. Do you think, though, is going to be executed that well?
Absolutely. And I think that is why you see the Republican Main Street Partnership members sticking behind Kevin McCarthy.
Is there a point, though, where they wouldn't have, if he had given, what was the line of too much? Gavels?
Gavels. It really came down to gavels, and that's not.
I mean,
really
if Chip Roy had been Rules Committee Chair instead of Tom
situation.
Cole, that would have been a huge.
That would have been a deal breaker for the Main Street members. Yeah. But Kevin never went there. I mean, and he's been keeping the Main Street members apprised, you know, every day, numerous times, conference calls, meetings with them. They're very much on board with him, and they like giving the power back to the committees. I mean, as everything goes smoothly, we're going to have 8 full committee chairmen within Main Street.
So, Scott Wong, does this mean? What does this mean for legislating? I mean, I have described it as I think we're going to look back at the fight over the speakership and call it patty cake.
This is a glimpse into the future of future fights ahead of us in these next 2 years. You mentioned the debt ceiling. That certainly is on a lot of people's mind, including the White House, because they got to figure out how they build a coalition together to raise the debt ceiling. There's going to be fights over whether or not to impeach top Biden administration officials like Alejandro Mayorkas and other folks, maybe the president of the United States himself.
Yeah.
And so this is, I think this is just a little taste of what's to come in the next 2 years.
So let me take a Sarah Longwell. Does Kevin McCarthy struggle here actually diffuse the impeachment bombs a little bit?
I don't know about that.
The votes aren't there. I just don't see how they would ever have the votes.
I don't buy
Don Bacon would participate in this, right? And there's probably more than one Don Bacon.
Yeah. I guess that's possible. I mean, the way that you just framed it, though, is that there's a governing wing and a chaos wing.
Yeah.
But the governing wing, all they want, they're saying, well, we want to cut all the IRS agents. We want to investigate Mayorkas. We want to impeach, you know, we want to go after Fauci. There's not really a governing wing. There's some governing people. But I'm sorry. I'm just so skeptical. The extent to which the party has shifted in this extreme direction for Kevin McCarthy to have to go and court Marjorie Taylor Greene in order to try to stave off, and he couldn't even stave it off, this, you know, 20-person insurrection within the Republican caucus, that is not a party that is ready to sort of deal in legislating. And I think that the extent to which this chaos caucus has now given itself carte blanche to, just create chaos. Imagine this rules negotiation. The rules negotiation that is about to happen, that's sort of used to be kind of pro forma. This is the rules that we're all going to play by. That's going to be exactly what we just saw with the speaker. And so I do not see the Republican Party in a good position right now to govern responsibly.
Do you think that the rules package fight, Sarah Chamberlain, is going to go smoothly next week?
It's not going to go smoothly, but it will get done, and there will be some compromises in there. I don't think everything that is being talked about now will end up being incorporated.
Guys, what role can Democrats play in that fight if it's on the floor?
Well, on the rules, you step back and you watch this clown show operate and see where it lands and say, I think from the president on down, they're making a judgment that this isn't a place of governing. But your question to, the new congressman-elect was around the debt ceiling for a reason, because you're thinking about must-pass stuff.
Yeah.
And so when you get into must-pass and omnibus in government funding stuff, now they have to be governing party, but the governing question is different, because now that's a situation which Democrat votes, I would argue.
By the way, that guy didn't sound like a guy who was comfortable using the debt ceiling.
No, exactly.
Right. Right. And you could really hear it. I mean, it was like he just didn't want to go there.
I could hear a number of Democrats joining with, at least that style of approach. But you and I know that there's going to be a faction of 20, whatever Republicans are saying, hell no, nihilism of zero. So now you've empowered the Democrats, right? So to the extent that gets done, it's the same situation as it was under Boehner, Ryan, when they can't control their own cost. The votes have to come from the Democratic side.
But if you don't control the Rules Committee, then what?
Well,
right? Like, isn't that the
I think
the
he's got the chair
scenario?
Of the Rules Committee.
Yeah.
So,
I think the Democrats have learned a lesson from this whole episode as well, right? They realize that if they stick together and hold the line, that they can be perceived as the adults in the room. They're making the argument to voters, see, I told you so. You shouldn't have put the Republicans in charge in the November midterms. Look how You know, look how much we were able to accomplish during the last 2 years under Biden and Democratic rule. And so Democrats will be, you know, the more they stick together, the more it makes it difficult for the Republican side.
Scott, maybe you have some reporting on this. Why didn't Democrats raise the debt ceiling during the lame duck?
I'm not exactly sure, but
yeah, I mean, neither am I, and I'd love to know the answer.
But here's a thought exercise that we've been having on Capitol Hill. Mm-hmm. What if they had not done the omnibus and finished that funding, and we were in a situation where we didn't have a Speaker of the House, and you would end up in a government shutdown?
But I want to go back to this decision on the debt ceiling. I understand standing on ceremony, mm-hmm. and. No, we're going to do this in a bipartisan way. Great. There's a lot of things we'd like to do in a bipartisan way. They stood on ceremony on this. Is that going to be something they regret 6 months from now?
Yeah, I think they're going to regret it. And look, the debt ceiling, that is part of these negotiations right now. Like, they're already trying to hold them hostage on the debt ceiling. I just think
it's the speaker vote of our budget process, isn't it?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
It really is.
That's
sort
exactly
of it's a must pass.
Yeah.
And it's a band of 10 or 20 can hold the country
and
hostage.
Think about what they learned from this. They learned that they can be celebrities. They learned that they can control the whole process. They can learn that they can be in charge of the works. Now, they might eventually relent on vote 14 or 15, but, you know, they got a lot of juice out of it. They got every concession they wanted. This becomes a win for those people, and they will use that the same way.
And Sarah Chamberlain, this is to me the real, and we kind of knew this, because I was talking with one committee chair who's been around a long time, and I said, how would Tom DeLay have handled this? And he said, those tools wouldn't have worked.
No.
That actually Tom DeLay's tools, which, you know, or even the velvet hammer of Nancy Pelosi, it doesn't work with this crowd because of what you just brought up, Sarah Longwell.
Yeah.
They have their own celebrity bases.
They do. And
right?
They don't care. And I would say they're the real rhinos. They're the Republicans in name only. I mean, we get criticized at Main Street for being that, but these guys aren't Republicans. Look what they've done to the country for the last 5-6 days.
I had somebody say something to me, a Democrat, who said, progressives run against Democrats, Democrats run against Republicans. And I've had Republicans say, conservatives run against Republicans, Republicans run against Democrats.
Yeah.
Do you accept that premise sometimes?
Absolutely.
Faz,
sometimes.
Do you accept that construction?
In moments and occasions. Yeah. I would say that the reason they didn't do the debt ceiling, going back to the good question that you raised, is I think President Biden has a really strong desire to break the fever on some of this stuff.
He does.
And he broke some of the fever, right, like he did, in the visit to McConnell,
right.
You know, do the event with McConnell this week. And I think he's like, you know, he's not going to do this too often. We're going to call this.
He thinks that's one word.
That's one way to break a fever, right?
And he may see political upside to it because, frankly, this debt, as the congressman-elect pointed out, Sarah Chamberlain, when has using the debt ceiling been good politics for the GOP?
It hasn't.
Yeah.
But it's not good politics for the president either. I mean, so why would Biden intentionally do this?
Because he's going to show a bipartisan compromise, just as he did. He's done this once before, to be clear.
I think it's a gamble. I think the Democrats should have done it.
The debt ceiling is a gamble for all of us at this table.
It is.
I mean, I don't want to be gambling with your savings and yours and all of ours. So anyway, I don't know if our week's truly over. I'm hesitant to say this is over. You think it's over.
I'm hoping. Yes.
All right. But was it over when the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor?
No.
All right, guys. Sarah Longwell, Sarah Chamberlain. Faz and Scott, thank you all. We're going to keep a close eye on the Hill throughout the hour in case we'll bring any developments on this story as they happen. But coming up, we're going to remember one of the darkest days in recent American history. The president, lawmakers, Capitol police officers and their families marked 2 years since the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. Just remind yourself, what if we had no speaker on January 6th? And what if we don't have a speaker on January 6th of 2025? We'll be right back.
From Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.
Hey, everyone. It's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Welcome back. While much of official Washington was focused on what was happening inside the House chamber on this January 6th, this has also been a solemn day on Capitol Hill outside of the chamber, because it's also the second anniversary of the January 6th attack on the Capitol. This morning, House Democrats, as well as, I believe, one Republican, commemorated the day on the steps of the Capitol, where they were joined by the families of those police officers whose lives were lost as a result of the attack.
Brian David Sicknick.
Metropolitan Police Department officers Gunther Hashida, Kyle DeFreitag, and Jeffrey Smith.
Officer Billy Evans.
The lawmakers then observed a moment of silence for 140 seconds. It was 1 second for each of the police officers seriously injured defending the Capitol. At the White House, President Biden awarded 14 people with Presidential Citizens Medals for their efforts to defend the Capitol and uphold the results of the 2020 election. Three of the officers who died as a result of the January 6th attack received medals posthumously.
On January the 6th, our democracy was attacked. There's no other way of saying it. The U.S. Capitol was breached, which had never happened before in the history of the United States of America, even during the Civil War. But on this day, 2 years ago, our democracy held, because we, the people, as the Constitution refers to us, we, the people, did not flinch. We, the people, endured. We, the people, prevailed. And on this day of remembrance, joined by the Vice President and the Second Gentleman and all of you, we honor a remarkable group of Americans who embodied the best before, during, and after January the 6th, 2021.
Meanwhile, in Sacramento, California Governor Gavin Newsom, who chose today to be sworn in for his second term, yes, he could pick his day to be sworn in, used the attack on the Capitol as a backdrop for his address to the state.
The ugliness that overflowed on January 6th, 2021, we know this, was in fact decades in the making. Fomented by people who have a very different vision of America's future. And as we all know too well, there's nothing original about their demagoguery. All across the nation, anxiety about social change has awakened long dormant authoritarian impulses, calling to question what America is to become, freer and fairer, or reverting to a darker past.
Kelly O'Donnell joins me now from the White House. And Kelly, it was just, look, the convergence of what's we've been dealing with on Capitol Hill this week, with this anniversary, and the fact that it doesn't feel like a bipartisan remembrance. And that is something that is still jarring, I think, to me and probably to you, to see that in this town.
And yet the kind of democracy and the messiness of it and the sort of discord that has played out on the House floor over the speaker is exactly what January 6th was there to protect. Democracy need not always be neat and tidy, but it is operating in that messy process to try to choose a new speaker, possible in part because of those people who stood up and put themselves in the way of those who were trying to impede that democracy 2 years ago. So part of what the president and the Biden White House wanted to do is, it's been a week of these split screen moments of trying to emphasize bipartisanship and to not allow January 6th to recede from the public consciousness, to use this day to say there are citizens, be they law enforcement officers, elected officials, election workers who are volunteers, or anyone who can find themselves in a position whereby simply following an oath or doing the right thing can in fact stand up for democracy, and that the impulses that Governor Newsom in California talked about that have been fomented over years are still present in our society, and who knows when they might be acted upon again. And so Americans who believe in these values need to be mindful of that ongoing potential threat and be prepared to stand up again. So using the President's Citizens Medal today, he was able to honor these Americans, retell their stories, give them support, and shine a light on what happened 2 years ago. And certainly, I'm sure you remember so much about where your day was. I've been having those recollections all through the day today. I was assigned to cover the then President Trump's rally in the morning and then all the activity through the day. And it comes back so vividly for us being here and being a part of the Washington community and around the country. People's memories may still be very vivid, or they may have receded. And the Biden White House wanted to definitely shine a light on these acts of democratic consciousness.
Very quickly, Kelly, reflect on this first week of the new year for this White House. I mean, they really sort of, it felt like the beginning of their reelection campaign in different ways.
Well, they are trying to set a really a plate of bipartisanship, outreach, governance, values like democracy and what it means, definitely sending the signal about what this president believes his term has already stood for and what he's about in terms of values going forward. I think that's a very reasonable assessment to say, does he intend to run? Well, there are things about what he's doing now that show that already.
Look, if he does end up running for reelection, I have a feel like a lot of the events of this week will play into that. The images might be something we see quite a bit of. Kelly O'Donnell on guard at the White House for us. Kelly, thank you. Speaking of the White House, they're touting their December jobs numbers. Why? Well, let me tell you. The Labor Department reported this morning that 223,000 new jobs were created last month. It beat economists' expectations. And the unemployment rate fell to 3.5%. It matches the lowest rate in half a century. Importantly, today's report thread the needle. It wasn't too hot to raise fears about inflation because wages grew less than expected, but it wasn't too cold to renew concerns of a recession. So what happened? Stock market actually liked it. As is tradition, the president was quick to try to take credit for the good report, saying we have more work to do and we may face setbacks along the way, but it is clear that my economic strategy of growing the economy from the bottom up and middle out is working. And in case you didn't know about the jobs report, Ron claimed the White House Chief of Staff's Twitter feed kept reminding people that it's been 50 years, always in all caps. After the break, the White House announces a new aid package for Ukraine that's set to include new weapons known as tank killers. We're going to have those details ahead. You're watching Meet the Press now. Welcome back. The Biden administration announced a new round of military assistance to Ukraine today. This new $3 billion package will include Bradley fighting vehicles, which the U.S. had previously been hesitant to provide Ukraine, as well as more artillery systems, surface-to-air missiles, and, of course, more ammunition. Today's announcement follows a joint statement from President Biden and German Chancellor Olaf Scholz yesterday that announced Germany's intention to join the U.S. in also sending Ukraine armored vehicles. Ukrainian President Zelensky has been pressing the West for tanks, longer-range missiles, more air defenses as the war in Ukraine approaches the one-year mark. Joining me now is our Pentagon correspondent, Courtney Kuby. You know, Courtney, boy, 3 months ago, trying to get the U.S. to do these Bradley fighting vehicles or Germany to do what they're doing to send more tanks was almost a non-starter. Was this a quid pro quo? If we did it, Germany would do it, and then that was the way to get this done?
There were a lot of defense officials who said that the Germans wanted the U.S. to be the ones who would act first to send some of these things. So, you know, these Bradley fighting vehicles, they look a lot like a tank. If, you know, any civilian looking at it would think that's what it is, but it's actually a little bit different. And in fact, as you said earlier, Chuck, what they're really known for and what they really have the capability that they're bringing to the Ukrainians here is taking out Russian tanks, the tank killers. They have these things on them called a TOW anti-tank missile. And the U.S. is giving about 500 of those TOW missiles to the Ukrainians as part of this package. This package, you mentioned that it's enormous, upwards of $3 billion, the biggest one we've seen since the invasion of Ukraine. But not just that, it really sort of foreshadows where the war is going right now. So the Bradleys, that's one. But there are hundreds of vehicles here in this package that are people movers. It's a recognition that the Ukrainians have to move more and more of their troops to where this main line of effort is right now in the east. Ammunition is another one. You know, we've almost become numb to some of these numbers, but the U.S. is sending hundreds of thousands of ammunition rounds to the Ukrainians in this one package alone. Even for the Bradleys, they don't fire artillery like the HIMARS and some of the other systems that we've come to know. But this smaller gun that the Bradley has on it, a 25 millimeter, the U.S. is providing 250,000 rounds for that. It's a recognition of the fact that in the coming weeks, days and weeks, there is a very fierce battle going on in the east. The U.S. recognizes, and according to what the Ukrainians need, the U.S. is recognizing here with this package that that fierce fighting is not ending. It's not slowing down. And in fact, it may even speed up in the coming weeks.
Courtney, speaking of numb, I don't think Americans fully appreciate, but try to put the amount of money and weapons that we have essentially given Ukraine to fight this war. This is the most money or weapons we've ever given to another country where we didn't help fire a shot. I mean, ever, and it's not even close. I mean, I don't think we are essentially fighting. We are not fighting this war. Ukraine's fighting this war with our weapons. Is that the bottom line?
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, there are other allies who are providing a lot of weapons. You know, you mentioned the Germans. People have been ponying up a lot of equipment, a lot of weapons. But the United States, the lion's share has been coming from the United States. And not just that, the U.S. has sort of taken over the lead.
Is there any parallel?
Shepherding all of these
other allies.
Can you
think of another parallel?
No. Yeah. Not at all. And I mean, just giving a sense again of the ammunition. I know it's hard to sort of get a sense of just how enormous this, what the U.S. has been committing here. But if you look at the kind of fighting that was going on in some place like Afghanistan at the height of the time, we weren't seeing anywhere near the level of expenditure of things like HIMARS, of ammunition, of howitzers that we're seeing in Ukraine. There are times where there are upwards of 20,000 artillery rounds firing back and forth in a day in Ukraine. That's a tremendous number.
I go back. I mean, we are essentially successfully weakening Russia without boots on the ground in a military conflict. If this ends up ending the way, you know, with Ukraine winning this war when all is said and done, it's a remarkable accomplishment.
Yes. And at the same time, while weakening Russia, this package, again, is another case where the U.S. and the allies are bringing Ukraine closer into NATO as well. By sending systems like Bradley's, they're integrating the Ukrainian military into many of these NATO systems. Simple things like being able to work together and communicate with one another with these Western systems. It's really bringing Ukraine more into the West.
That's an important point. It really is this major debate. I mean, at this point, NATO might as well be a member of NATO. I mean, the only thing missing are NATO troops.
Yeah, that's right. And it's, again, it's not just the U.S. that's doing it, but the Germans and other NATO allies. NATO has sort of this defense architecture where many of the equipment all works together. And because in many cases, Ukraine has expended so much of their sort of old Soviet era equipment and ammunition, they had to get some of the Western equipment and particularly the weapons, things like the HIMARS, and then the rounds, the artillery rounds that go with them. It's really brought Ukraine closer and closer into NATO, even though they're not technically a member at this point.
We got a long way to go, but I have a feeling in a few years, maybe look back and just how this could change our defense posture or how we fund. Anyway, this is a remarkable story if it comes to fruition here. Courtney Kuby at the Pentagon Force. Courtney, thank you.
Thanks.
Coming up, we're going to be joined by the elections chief from one of the biggest battlegrounds on the map, Michigan. She was just honored today at the White House for her role in defending democracy on the second anniversary of the January 6th attack. You're watching Meet the Press now.
Do you have the votes for speaker tomorrow?
McCarthy, do you have the votes for speaker locked in tomorrow?
I think we're going to have a good day tomorrow.
Are you going to stay in the race, Lee McCarthy?
You're not dropping off. I'm not going anywhere. Doesn't matter. I still have the most votes.
I feel good today, really. I felt very positive yesterday. I feel more positive today.
You know, my father always told me one thing. It's not how you start, it's how you finish.
We're going to make progress. We're going to make progress. We're going to make progress.
So what's it going to take to get over the top here?
We'll get it done tonight.
Well, I have two veterans of when it comes to leadership on the House and working for leadership. Pat Shakur is back with me. I told you his experience with Nancy Pelosi, along with Brendan Buck, former communications advisor to two other speakers, Ryan and Boehner. He's now an NBC political analyst. So, Brendan, I haven't heard from you this hour. Is McCarthy celebrating too soon? He's pretty confident he's got it. It seems like he does.
Yeah, I guess we never doubted him, did we? it does feel like he's going to get there. The small number, I mean, this is the pressure you needed. Like, 20 is a lot of people to peer pressure. Yeah. This number is so small. I think there's a very good chance he gets there. It's a remarkable turnaround. And like this morning, you know, just thinking this.
What do you think broke it?
I don't. I was surprised that it was as many as 20 that opposed him in the beginning.
Thought it was bigger than you thought.
It was bigger than I thought it was going to be, and it was a much bigger swing back the way towards him this morning. I think at some point you have to learn how to declare victory. I think some people realized, like we did, that this could be going on for weeks, and sometimes it's personal. You don't want to be doing this for weeks, and if you look for, like, people need an out. And there was an out, and they didn't know when the next out was going to be.
Wasn't obvious what else they could get.
It wasn't obvious what else they could get. So they, okay, if I want to get off this train at some point, this is my moment to get off of it. And I think they took it, and not quite there yet, but I think it's good for him to be in a good mood right now.
I'm outsider watching it, but I would say that there was a split in a strategy, to the extent they had any strategy to begin with, right, of the Gaetz crew. But at one point, I think they wanted to see whether you were really pro-McCarthy enough, and it was a test of wills. So the first strategy was to say, well, would a Jim Jordan or whoever else you want to, if we had a blind vote, do we think that our guy could trump him? And then it'd be a test of wills. Let's test their wills and find out how much McCarthy's got. And then I think at some point it started to shift and say, okay, well, now we got to do House rules and, like, get something out of this thing. And I think that's where they're going to. I
mean, they got a great deal. Like, let's be clear. They got a lot out of him. So if you were ever going to be able to say yes.
Well, I was just going to say, if Paul Ryan had to be speaker under these set of rules, what would have meant?
Well, he was speaker under maybe one of the biggest things, which is the motion to vacate said it won. And that was what we lived under. It's what John Boehner lived under. It feels very inevitable at the end. This was always going to have to be the rule that he was going to live with. It's some of these other things that are very difficult.
That's what I'm trying to get at.
The Rules Committee is a big concern for me. I mean, we'll see how many members they are adding to the Rules Committee from this group. But if it's enough, it could block anything that Republicans want to bring up to the floor. Representation on other committees. Some of these spending bills, spending levels, I guess probably my biggest concern. And, you know, I was there for John Boehner. I was there for Paul Ryan. In that changeover, some of the advice that John Boehner gave Paul Ryan was, you can promise effort, don't promise outcomes. And we have a situation where I'm a little worried that Kevin McCarthy is promising some outcomes, things that you can't control. Because even though you're Speaker of the House, you still need 218 votes to get there. And if he's promising, I can get you a debt limit deal that looks like this, or I can get you a spending levels that look like this, I don't know that you can promise that and actually achieve it. And that could come back and I guess it's a problem for another day, get through this. Right. But I worry a little for Kevin McCarthy that some of the promises he's made are not achievable on his own.
Nothing unifies the Democrats like the Republicans.
Well, I would say the best person coming out of it in many ways is Hakeem Jeffries. Like, you could have argued
because he suddenly has a united.
Totally. Office. Like, they've voted, how many, 13 times, 15 times over there? Like, to the extent that people were thinking about, okay, how's Hakeem Jeffries going to stand up, build the unity in this caucus? He's got everything. Summer Lee comes in, Greg Kassar comes in, boom, I got my progressives, I got my old school.
It? I mean, that's my question.
It's easy now.
You lock it in. You lock it in with some degree of consensus, and it's his opportunity to shine. But now, I mean, people are always looking at the leader to say, is there a chink at a moment where you see a weakness? And I think that was McCarthy, and many people saw a weakness. But with Hakeem, I don't think anyone sees a weakness there.
So how do we raise the debt ceiling? What's that going to look like?
I have no idea. I mean, some of the conversation has been that use a discharge petition, which is a mechanism where...
I am sorry that I have to say the phrase and that we have to explain it, but please do.
It is a process
sounds
where...
Sounds like a medical condition.
If 218 members petition. Literally sign a petition that says, I want this bill to come up, even if leadership is blocking it, it automatically triggers a vote on a bill. So under this theory, all the Democrats would sign this petition to bring up a debt limit increase, plus a handful of Republicans who don't want to see this blow up. That's a really risk. I know this is a strategy that they're really, you know, thinking about using, but it's really risky because it's completely out of your control. And you're basically saying, no, don't do that. Yes, please. Someone go ahead and sign it. And that's not a real way to lead. I think you have to at least acknowledge we do want the debt limit to be increased. But I don't know that he can say that. He certainly can't say it until he gets the votes.
You know, something that was intriguing to me this week, Faz, was how much political capital Biden truly believes he has. And he used some of it this week on the border because he took some incoming on his decision to expand Title 42.
Right.
When you're getting praise from Manchin and criticism from Menendez and Alex Padilla, you know, you're doing a bit of triangulating
And then sat with Mitch McConnell, literally.
Kentucky. These are things that 6 months ago, a lot of progressives would have been screaming about. Now, right, he can... Yeah. He's got some room to run.
It will be one of his legacies among many will be that Biden was a man for the moment offered to him by the state of the Republican Party. If you look at the Trump trajectory.
And you say this is somebody that you didn't think he was the man of the moment for you.
Well, I say that. Exactly. The person of the moment. We know why he rose through the primary. We know why he rose in the general, why he's in many ways didn't have to campaign in a general because of COVID. Right. Why is this guy doing so well? Because the state of the Republican Party has allowed him to basically conquer a state of decent, normal governance.
Brendan, how do the Republicans prevent this from looking like the same movie that I've covered for 30 years? Which is a Democratic president seeking re-election with a Republican House who goes too far. It re-elected Bill Clinton. It re-elected Barack Obama. Tell me how.
I've been saying this for months now. Yeah, I mean, the overreach is the biggest. Like, we're not going to overreach legislatively. I don't think, because we can't really do a whole lot. But some of these investigations, you know, going after Hunter Biden just looks crazy. And that's our biggest problem, is that we don't look like a serious party tackling serious issues. But that's not what the base wants, and so we're going to keep going down these rabbit holes. It's a great.
Just wait till the presidential primary start.
Yeah, exactly.
That's going to add something to
DeSantis. Has been quiet on that, by the way.
Oh yes, he has.
Pro Jim Jordan guy.
He has been extraordinarily quiet. It's like. Like, not even engaging at all.
No.
We'll see what happens when he has to engage. Baz, Brendan, thank you both. This Sunday on Meet the Press, I'll have exclusive interviews with the House Democratic leader, Akeem Jeffries, and the incoming Oversight Committee chair and Kevin McCarthy ally, James Comer. We'll be right back. You're watching Meet the Press now. Welcome back. As we mentioned earlier, President Biden honored 14 people today with Presidential Citizen Medals for their work protecting democracy in the wake of the 2020 presidential election. One of the people who received that honor was the Michigan Secretary of State, Jocelyn Benson. Michigan was one of the states at the heart of former President Trump's efforts to undermine and overturn 2020 election results. Benson testified to Congress last year that she was continually threatened and harassed by extremists in the wake of the election. She described how weeks before the January 6th insurrection, protesters gathered outside of her house to threaten her and her family. Well, the Michigan Secretary of State, Jocelyn Benson, joins me now. First, I want to congratulate you. A presidential medal is something that I'm sure it still hasn't quite set in. Just tell me how you're feeling right now.
Yeah, it was very surreal, especially to be honored alongside of such extraordinary law enforcement officers and other election heroes. And to be, to have spent so much time with the president and the vice president today on this momentous anniversary of January 6th, it really is my heart is bursting. But also, I'm very clear-eyed that the work is not over, that this is an honor and a recognition that will only really, I hope, embolden all of us who are honored today to keep doing our duty to the Constitution and defending democracy wherever we are.
What does that work now mean for you going forward? I know we'd spent some time a couple months ago. You were telling me about efforts to work with other secretaries of state, trying to educate the population a little bit better, try to push back at misinformation and disinformation. What does that look like next year, this year, and they run up to 2024?
I think two things, just as you mentioned. One, really building out that collaborative partnership, particularly with other secretaries and local election officials in battleground states and with law enforcement, to be prepared for any other tactics that we see come our way as we approach the 2024 election cycle. And the second is to continue to implore lawmakers at the state and federal level to invest in the security and protecting the security of our elections, not just the infrastructure of elections, but the people themselves. So I'll be working in Michigan, and I know many of other colleagues, including my newly appointed colleague in Pennsylvania, who has also honored today, Al Schmidt, to make sure that we are collaborating, sharing data, trying to recenter the conversation around facts and truth, and building faith in our democracy and investing in the security of those who guard it.
What kind of scar tissue do you have from the 2020 election and January 6th? Do you still hear from people? Do you still and how do you get over that?
You know, it's interesting. I talked with a lot of the officers here today about just that, you know, that recognizing the PTSD that can come from going through what so many of us have gone through and knowing that it's not over, that at any point, which maybe is part of it, knowing that we're always going to be watching our back and prepared for any attack, either on ourselves as people or on the work that we do or on the voice and the votes of the American people. But I have a lot of faith in our ability and that to overcome those attacks, which also is part of the impact of going through what we've been through these last few years. We've gotten stronger. We've gotten more sophisticated. We collaborate more. And because of that, I feel we're stronger than we were in 2020, though we're also a little bit battle tested and the wounds are still there.
You're visiting Washington today. Have you ever thought about working here in an elective capacity?
You know, I really believe that defending democracy is the most important issue of our time. And I get to do that in my current job, which I love. But I'm always going to look for ways that I can continue to do more to defend democracy. Mm-hmm. And so we'll see how that unfolds in the months and years ahead.
That sounds like somebody that might be interested in running for the U.S. Senate in 2024?
I'm really happy in my current job, and I just took the oath of office for my second term a few days ago. And, you know, my eyes are focused actually on 24, not as a candidate, but as someone who will be working to protect the voice and the vote of every citizen in our state. And that's the job that I have now and the job that I love.
I'm curious, do you think having electing the chief of elections overall is a good idea? You and I talked about this before, and it is what it is. In Michigan, different states have do. Have you thought about that, like, in an ideal setting? Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's ultimately a good thing. Look, it comes down to the person, and it could be a Democrat or a Republican. But if you have people of integrity who tell the truth and fight for democracy on either side of the aisle, then we're going to be okay. And whether you have an appointed election official like my colleague Al Schmidt is going to be in Pennsylvania or elected in, like myself in Michigan, Republican or Democrat, we do our jobs. And if we do them well, it doesn't matter necessarily how we get there. I'll just add, however, being elected enables greater accountability for us to ensure as voters we're electing secretaries of state who reflect and protect democracy. So I side with ultimately the election of secretaries of state, but good people can come through the appointment process as well.
Jocelyn Benson, the Secretary of State for Michigan, congratulations again. It's something, you know, like I said, I'm sure it's one of those pinch me moments. So congratulations and enjoy.
Thank you. Thanks. Indeed it is.
That does it for us this hour. Tune in tonight at 9 p.m. for NBC News special. It marks the second anniversary of January 6th. My colleague Hallie Jackson is taking a deeper dive into the January 6th committee's final report and the key moments of their investigation. Don't miss it. And speaking of Hallie Jackson, she's picking up our coverage right now.
From Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.